Well, it can be a creepy and curious world out there, and this year we've been looking at some of the critters that we don't know very much about, finding out more about their lives and even ourselves. Joining us this morning is Dr. Paul McDonald from the University of New England. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Kelly.
And how's New Armidale treating you this morning?
Very nice. Beautiful day. Another day in paradise here.
Lovely day. Good to hear. Well, you were talking to us a couple of weeks ago about the science of sweat and how humans use it. It was pretty fascinating to find out how we respond to the sweat of others and our own sweat. But there's been a bit of an update that you found since then.
Yeah, that's right. It's not directly linked to sweat, but more how we smell. Now, remember when we were talking about some of the things behind sweat, we were talking about how different people perceive the same smell differently, and some would find it attractive and others the complete reverse at times. So what some researchers have done in New Zealand is actually look at some genetic correlates of smell. So they've looked in areas of human DNA which are next to our olfactory receptor genes. Now, olfactory receptors, they're the mechanism how we actually smell. So when you breathe air into your nose, these are the parts of the body that detect various chemicals in the air, and then our brains put that together and register that as a smell. So often when things are close to each other on in our DNA, they're actually linked in function. So that's why they had a bit of a look in those particular areas. And they actually found genetic correlates with four particular types of smells. So they were malt, apple, blue cheese, which is, yeah, I definitely don't have a positive reaction to that one. And the other one was a floral smell, which they state smells a little bit like violets, apparently. So, but really interesting, they were able to test people with these particular smells and also look at their genetic makeup, which is something that's not been done too much before. And they found that depending on what genes particular people had, it influenced their ability to detect some of these smells. So if you didn't have the right gene, then you weren't able to smell apple very effectively, for example, and so on. So there was no geographic variation. So depending on people's different heritage or which part of the world they came from and so on didn't influence this. So it really seems to be a little bit of random mixing, I guess, of what genes you particularly happen to end up with affects how you actually perceive the world. And the term that they came up with was that we all live in our own little flavour world, which I thought was quite nice. But
pretty cool. How do we know? Do we know? How can we discover which flavour world we live in?
No, that's not hasn't been done yet, but I'm sure it's not too far away. There's, of course, all these tests now, so you can determine your risk of particular diseases and so on. So perhaps it won't be too far away, and we'll test our children, and unfortunately they'll be deemed to a life where they will no longer not be able to smell apples or something. But it's an interesting little insight into how hardwired some of these things are, and we sort of can take for granted that a smell is just a smell and everyone smells it the same. But these types of research are really starting to show that that's not indeed the case, and it perhaps explains a little bit why when I read the tastings on wine bottles, for example, why I can't detect the vast majority of those. I think I'm missing quite a few smell genes, but anyway.
Imprinting is something that they talk about in Twilight, Paul.
Oh, do they? Oh. Yeah, straying into dangerous waters there. I have no information on that.
But don't tell me there's some kind of real basis to this sort of science fiction world.
Well, I'm deeply unqualified to talk about Twilight, which is I'm pretty happy about, to be honest. my kids are too young. But no, we do. There is imprinting that operates in human world. Now, there's two distinct types. Well, two main types that we tend to talk about. Now, the first one is what we call filial imprinting, and that's where you see you might have seen on the TV and docos, or even out and about, where ducklings will follow their parents. For example, they hatch early on. They imprint on what a parent looks like, which is sort of early on in their life what they see that resembles a head, for example, and then they follow them around. And that's very useful. Something like a duck, the chicks feed themselves, so the parents just need to take them to somewhere where there's food, so they can wander around and the young follow and don't get lost, which is very useful. The other one is sexual imprinting, which might be a little bit strange to think about it, but animals have a problem in terms of, well, they have many problems, as do we all, but one of the problems they have is how they actually find a mate. So you think about it, a bird in a nest hatches, for example, there's no mirrors that they look at. So one of the questions we think about is how does a sparrow, for example, know that it's a sparrow and need to find a sparrow mate and so on when it grows up. Now, it doesn't happen in all species, but quite a few species, they actually imprint on their siblings. So they're able to judge by their siblings in the nest or whatever it might be, effectively what species they are and what type of mate they should look for in the future. So they've done some experiments where you can actually cross-foster chicks, for example. So you can take chicks of one species and put them in another species' nest and then follow them throughout their life and look at who they mate with and so on. So they have established this as being a really strong pattern in quite a number of species now. So
wow.
We don't... well, I'm not sure. I couldn't find any information that humans actually imprint on their siblings, which probably is reassuring to many, I'm sure. Yes. But there was an interesting study that came out recently from Poland, which looked at female preference for mate choice. Now, what they asked a number of participants to do is to look at various images of men's faces and rate them as either attractive or unattractive, you know, on a scale between the two. And they were also asked to rate, the women participants rate their relationship with their father. So whether that was very good and happy, I guess, right through to strained or broken, whatever the case may be, at the other end of the continuum. They also then supplied a picture of their father, which the researchers compared and to their mate choice preferences. And really interesting, what they found is these women were rating faces as more attractive if they shared particular characteristics of their father, but only if they had a good relationship with their father. So if they'd had a falling out with their father, for example, or you know, perhaps they never knew their father for whatever reason, that sort of thing, there was no relationship there. So it seemed to be if they had a positive experience or relationship with their father, then they were transferring some of the father's characteristics onto their eventual mate choice decisions. So really interesting study and something that, perhaps it gives us a little bit of insight and, you know, I don't know if male partners out there probably want to have a wee look at their father-in-law and just... probably a little bit too much information, but there's it's really interesting because there's lots of these things happening in the background that I find them really interesting, that you know, people just take a lot of these things for granted, but there's actually lots of different strategies in there, and we're not that dissimilar to lots of different animals in terms of how we solve some of these life problems, if you like.
Yeah, we found an interesting story was brought to our attention out of Queensland the other week. I guess when we talk about imprinting, where an emu had sort of become quite protective of a particular Brahmin bull, and really had wouldn't let anyone else mate with it. Was very protective of him, and did her special dance for him and everything. So, can it happen across species? Do you think? Or
yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's certainly. it can happen in two different ways. Sometimes you see those types of behaviour if. Animals are hormonally primed to provide parental care, for example, and the clutch fails and they might transfer that behaviour onto the next nearest thing. Also, you have that filial imprinting we spoke about earlier with the ducks. That can happen with other species.
Mm. And indeed, you see that often, don't you? That the different mothers take on the adopt cubs or kittens or those sort of things.
Yeah. Absolutely, and it can lead to real problems sometimes with... people that are looking after injured animals, for example, falcons and eagles are a great example where people feed them as a chick. They associate people as the same species and provider of food, for example. So if you're no longer feeding those chicks once they grow up as adults, then they respond to you as they would another falcon, which is basically to attack and say, hand the food over. So yeah, it'd be quite practical implications of getting that wrong.
Oh dear, okay. Some women like to think of themselves as masterful multitaskers and look for that kind of ability in their mate as well. Does the animal kingdom have similar requests?
Yes, animal kingdom also, lots of examples of females making males do horrible things and jumping through all sorts of difficult hoops. Multitasking, I don't believe that. It's clearly an urban myth, but putting that aside, in this example, we're looking at frogs, and think about frogs in terms of when they're breeding. Pretty much all they get from their mate is sperm, perhaps access to a territory, but really there's not a whole lot of parental care there in a lot of species, so they don't have a lot to go on in terms of choice. So in this particular species, choice is based upon how well males are at doing two particular tasks at the same time. Now, when male frogs call, two particular things they can vary. The first is the actual call rate, so how many pulses of sound they produce, you know, in 10 seconds or a minute, whatever the case might be, and also how long each pulse is. Now, very, I think perhaps unfairly, but in this particular case, the females prefer males that produce more rapid call rates, but also longer pulses. Now, when you think about that, that's asking them to almost do the impossible, because obviously the longer the pulse, the harder it is to fit more pulses in a given time. So the analogy that has been used is, it's a bit like asking a human, for example, to run on a treadmill and talk at the same time. Like you're trying to do two things at once aerobically, that's quite difficult. Mm. So when they look at the actual mate choice preferences of what's attractive to these females, they really prefer the ones that are able to do both the best. And we see similar relationships in some birds in terms of their trill rate as well. So it seems to be a reasonably common characteristic of females that they're basing their choice on a difficult task. And one way we can make tasks difficult for males is to sort of ask them to do two or three things at the same time. So multitasking is a universal trait, perhaps, that's seen as difficult.
All right, let's finish up then. You found some interesting things that humans do in normal situations, but maybe we see what's some way to interpret when our sports people celebrate a victory.
Yes, well, I was thinking about this when I was lucky enough to be watching the mighty Cats crush the Swans on the weekend, and you know, as footy finals approach, let me get that subtle plug in there. But no, humans, there's a really distinct behaviour that often happens. You see it with sportsmen after they kick a goal, score a try, or whatever. You know, win a race in the Olympics and so on. And a lot of this research is all linked around Olympic events, interestingly enough. There's a lot of research happens behind the scenes for the Olympics. And what they thought they were initially were pride displays. So you see the chest is pumped out, often fists are clenched, and a bit of a roar or yell, if you like, after something good has happened for that particular player. Now, as I said early on, we thought this was a bit of pride and you know, sort of celebrating one's own achievement and so on. But there's been a number of studies on this more recently, and one of them asked people from both the US and South Korea, which are very different cultures in terms of background and how they perceive different behaviours, to score particular images of celebrations that were occurring in the Olympics. Judo, I think it was, off the top of my head. But looking at how the winners express themselves after winning. And rather than pride, they consistently came back to scoring it as triumph. So it really seems to be a signal that's really hardwired into our way we view other people, and associate that particular behaviour with a triumph one. Now, the follow-up research to that was even more interesting, because they looked at the Paralympics and were able to compare athletes that were participating but still had their full vision, with athletes who had been blind since birth. Yeah. So they were never able to actually observe the postures and so on of other athletes. And interestingly, even those blind athletes that couldn't learn the behaviour, if you like, still expressed these so-called triumph displays. So it really does seem to be something that a real way of showing off and enforcing and really making sure that everyone knows that that particular individual has just done well, if you like, and is superior or dominant to the others.
Isn't that amazing? So it's really hardwired into us, that sense of celebration or winning victory.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you think about all sorts of social animals, which we are, a very social beast. All these types of dominance and display type behaviours, there's often something along those lines. So, you know, in hindsight, it makes perfect sense that we'd have something, but really interesting that it still persists and it does appear to be not a learnt behaviour.
Wow. All right. And just briefly then, the 3-second rule, there's something in it?
Absolutely. and it's you will be looking at your watch after talking about this. I have been. But apparently, again, looking at the Olympics, they timed a whole range of behaviours, and it turns out that the 3-second rule does seem to apply to a whole lots of things that we do. So everything from those celebration hugs, which you see at the end of the race between athletes, and it's now been expanded and they've looked in a range of activities, things like goodbye waves, even a lot of our riffs in music that is popular, and even babies in their sort of babbling bouts and so on, all seem to apply to this 3-second rule. They occur in sort of 3-second bouts or cycles, if you like. Now, there's another study looked at the zoo, animals in a zoo as well, and they also found lots of variation, but again, an average time frame of events such as chewing and so on being about 3 seconds. So lots still to be done here, but a nice weird, I guess, insight into a almost like a rhythm of life, the authors argue, of how we actually divide up our world and think about events in our world. And it is interesting if you think about, if that was a minute timescale, for example, you would perceive events much more differently than relatively small and rapid timescale. Lets you perhaps pick up and attend to changes in the environment, you know, more easily or rapidly.
Mm, there you go. All right. So I'll be watching my clock. Yeah, I'll be looking at the clock, I think, through the rest of the day, see what happens.
Well, you know, you try and give your friend
a... Have you found things in your life?
Well, it is interesting because if you, you know, a handshake, if you extend that too long, it feels very awkward and so on, and all these types of behaviours. So perhaps have a wee look at your watch and see when that awkwardness kicks in. And if this is right, it should be about 3 seconds.
Yeah. All right. Fantastic. Paul, some interesting things for us to ponder this morning, especially the flavour world. It'll be an interesting one to see where you fit in that world.
Yes.
But you have a great week and we'll catch you again soon. Thanks, Paul.
Likewise. Thanks, Kelly. Cheers.